Archaeological Park of Paphos. Introduction. Go up the steps after the ticketing office, and you will see stretching out in front of you the region where Neo-Paphos was located during the ancient times. According to Strabo and Pausanias, the city of Paphos was built for the first time in the 12th century BC, after the end of the Trojan War by Agapino, king of Tegea, in Peloponnesus. This tradition refers to Ballet Paphos, which was situated approximately 17 kilometers from the current city of Paphos, in the village of Kuklia. The famous sanctuary, known around the entire ancient world, dedicated to the great goddess of Cyprus, that was identified as Aphrodite, goddess of love and beauty, was also located there. Neo-Paphos was founded at the end of the 4th century BC by King Nicocles, the last king of Paphos. Nicocles decided to build on this cape a new city around a small bay that was about to become the port of the city. The city was built according to the Hippodamian plan, with an organized grid street system, and was based on an urban plan with squares of buildings and well-defined zones of commercial, public, and residential use. It was protected by tall walls and covered an area of about 950,000 square meters. Neo-Paphos became the economic and commercial center of the kingdom, while Pele-Paphos remained the religious center and seat of the king. Later, during the 2nd century BC, the Ptolemies transferred the capital of Cyprus to Paphos because of the city's proximity to Alexandria and of its large port. This was used as a naval base, but also for the trade and export to Egypt of the island's raw materials, mainly copper and timber. In 58 BC, Cyprus passed into the hands of the Romans, and Paphos remained the political and administrative center of the island. The Roman proconsul resided here. The city acquired an even greater importance, and honorary names like Augusta, Claudia, and Flavia were given to it. The climax of its blooming was at the end of the 2nd, beginning of the 3rd century AD. During that period, rich public and private buildings were erected, and many of their ruins have survived to the present time and can be seen in this archaeological park. The majestic public buildings of this period, like the Agora, the Theatre, the Odeon, the Asclepion, and temples dedicated to various gods and emperors, the sewage system, the public baths, testify the high standard of living of its residents. The libraries, the theatres, and the gymnasia also testify their high intellectual level. The Temple of Aphrodite in Pele-Paphos became the religious and intellectual centre of the island and evolved into one of the biggest religious centres of the whole empire. Christian places of worship made their appearance after the Edict of Religious Freedom in the 4th century AD by Constantine the Great. At the beginning of the 4th century AD, Paphos was destroyed by earthquakes like other cities in Cyprus. The city was rebuilt. The capital, however, was transferred to Salamis and was named henceforth Constantia. Despite the fact that Paphos was reconstructed, became the seat of a bishop, and many churches were built there, it did not regain its old glamour. A part of its old glory revived during the Byzantine period, and later on during the Lusignan period, when new fortification works and churches were built. Its decline set in once more during the Venetian period, and even more under the Ottoman domination. The inhabitants abandoned the region around the port and built a new settlement in the plateau, where the centre of the town is to be found today. In the centuries that followed, its residents took from the area of Neo-Paphos ready-dressed stone blocks in order to build their houses. Thus, the entire wall structure was unfortunately destroyed, as well as the murals that decorated the walls. Go up the steps after the ticketing office, and you will see on your right-hand side the visitor's centre, where you will find information and publications on the archaeological park. Follow from there the pathway to the right, and then turn left to find the house of Dionysos. The sign that you see before entering the house informs us that Neo-Paphos is one of the monuments that belong to the World Heritage of UNESCO. Apart from the various houses where the mosaics are to be found, excavations were carried out eastwards in the Roman Odeon, the Asclepion, and the Agora. They date to the first half of the second century. The House of Dionysus. This site was discovered by chance during levelling works. The discovery of broken pieces of tesserae led to more systematic excavations that brought to light a rich residence of the Roman period. Initially, it was considered as the palace of the Roman proconsul due to its rich decoration. Later, however, after the discovery of the real palace in the same area and the finding of even more mosaics in the region, it became clear that this type of decoration was something usual in wealthy residences of this period. The mosaics belonged to the last buildings that were erected here, on the ruins of older ones. The building occupies an area of 2,000 square meters, of which 556 are covered with mosaics. God Dionysus, god of wine, is often represented on the mosaic representations. Thus, the site has been named the House of Dionysus. It was built in the beginning of the 2nd century AD and was destroyed during the earthquakes of the 4th century. The impressive size of this residence, that exceeds the 40 rooms, including 15 mosaic floors, testifies the high standard of living of the inhabitants during the Roman period. The atrium, the central courtyard, acted as the nucleus of the residence, and the most important rooms were built around it. A colonnaded portico opened on all four sides of the atrium. The roofs sloped towards the centre, aiming at collecting rainwater and directing it into a cistern underneath the atrium's floor. The residence also had a central drainage system, which was connected with the main drain that ran under the road. There were rooms in the residence which were open to visitors and decorated with impressive floor mosaics and murals. The bedrooms had simpler floors, decorated with pebbles, while the kitchens, the workshops, baths and latrines were covered by tamped earth flooring. Apart from the main atrium, there were another two open courtyards and a pond for fish, an aquarium, covered with pink plaster, which you can see outside the covered space. The subjects of mosaics, which covered all floors of communal use, originate from Greek mythology, and they are all found in the original position in which they were discovered, except from the first one that represents the mythical monster, Scylla. The most ancient mosaics are geometric and made out of white, black, or brown pebbles. The immediate next stage was the making of mosaics with cut, rough stones, and their perfection was succeeded with the use of tesserae, cut in square. The mosaics were either colourful or black and white. They were made by workshops, and most of the work was executed by apprentices, while the master craftsman was making the main figure composition, which was the most difficult. Once the craftsmen were levelling the ground where the mosaic was to be made, a mixture of small stones and thick lime mortar was laid. On top of this, a second layer from crushed stones and pottery fragments mixed with lime mortar was added, and above this, a fine layer of plaster. While the plaster was still wet, tesserae were laid in it. In order to make the mosaic more resistant, they rubbed the surface with marble dust, sand, and lime. All tesserae are made out of local stones, of imported marble, but also of glass of rare colours, such as bright orange, blue, nuances of green, yellow, and others. Each tessera measures about 1 cubic centimetre, except from the ones used for the human figures, which are smaller. These representations were not the creation of a craftsman. They pre-existed as drawings, and the householder could select the subjects they wished. Many items of daily use have also been discovered in this site and are exhibited in the Archaeological Museum of Paphos. On entering the house through the entrance, there is a mosaic to the left which is very different from the others. This originates from a Hellenistic residence of the end of the 4th century, which dated before the Roman one and was found by chance in 1977 during the works for the construction of the shed. The spot where it was found was not accessible to the general public, and thus it was transferred to the position that is found today. On this mosaic, we have the representation of a monster, Scylla, known to us via Odyssey. It is a monster that was the combination of a woman, a dog, and a fish. Scylla was not always a monster, but a beautiful woman, in whom Glafkos, a handsome young man, fell in love. She, however, did not respond to his feelings. For this reason, Glafkos sought the help of sorceress, Circe, who was herself in love with him. Thus, instead of helping him, blinded by jealousy, she threw magic herbs in the bay where the young girl swam. When Scylla entered the water, she was transformed into a monster that remained in the water for good, sinking the ships that passed by that spot. Next to it, two dolphins are represented on a smaller panel, and the whole composition is flanked by a frame with geometric patterns. This mosaic is made with white, black, and brown pebbles, a completely different technique from the other mosaics of the residence. It is one of the most ancient mosaics that have been discovered in Cyprus, as it was made towards the end of the 4th, beginning of the 3rd century BC. Exactly opposite, we see the first mosaic of the Roman house. It represents Narcissus, son of river Cephisos, and the nymph Liriope, who was so beautiful that many boys and girls fell in love with him. Narcissus, however, was too proud to respond. One day while he was hunting, he was seen by nymph Echo, who fell madly in love with him, but he did not respond. She was despaired by his rejection and hid in the mountains and in the forests. She became thinner and thinner until she vanished into thin air and only her voice remained. For this reason, Echo is heard by everyone but seen by no one. Gods, in order to punish Narcissus for causing so much unhappiness, cursed him to be punished in the same way. Thus, one day when Narcissus sat on the bank of a lake, he saw his reflection in the water and fell in love with himself. Brought to despair by these feelings, he was worn and wasted away with love. Gods, however, felt pity for him and turned him into a flower that grows near the water, the Narcissus. In this panel, Narcissus admires himself in the water of the lake. A part of this mosaic was destroyed during leveling works, and thus a large section of the geometric pattern is modern. Next to Narcissus, we see the mosaic of the Four Seasons, which, as the previous one, was badly damaged and restored. It consists of 5 panels, one on each corner and one in the centre. We recognise in them the personifications of 4 seasons: summer in the upper left, crowned with ears of corn and a sickle in the hand; spring in the upper right is crowned with flowers and holds a shepherd's crook; autumn in the lower right holds a pruning knife and is crowned with leaves; winter is represented in the lower left as an old man with grey hair and beard. The figure in the middle represents most probably the personification of time. All panels are framed by a band of cubes in perspective, and in the outer frame there are 2 tablets with the inscription "Rejoice" on the one and "In Thyself" on the other. This type of inscription usually existed at the entrance of residences, which leads to the conclusion that this is also where the entrance of the house was located. We proceed to the left, going up the wooden bridge. The largest room is unfolding in front of us, measuring 11.5 by 8.5 metres. This room was the tablinum, a place which was used as a reception room, but also as a dining room. The floor is decorated with a mosaic that includes vintage scenes in the centre. On its 3 sides, small shields, known as peltae, are depicted on a wide band with geometric patterns, and further out lay a geometric pattern based on the meander. Unfortunately, both bands on the western side were destroyed. When the room was used for dining, guests were eating reclining on couches, which were arranged like the letter U, in the area where the band with peltae is located. In that way, all guests were facing the centre, where there was most probably some kind of entertainment, perhaps dancers. The space left behind the couches remained free so that servants assisting the guests could circulate. The big representation at the entrance of this room depicts the triumphal procession of Dionysus returning from an expedition to India. The god is seated on a chariot, drawn by 2 panthers in the centre of the composition. His followers are on his left and right side. Satyrs, Bacchantes, God Pan, who was half man and half goat with horns on the forehead, and two Indian slaves, recognisable by their dark skin. On the left and right side of the Triumph of Dionysus, there are two rather incongruous figures with the rest of the panel. These are the Dioscuroi, the twin brothers, Castor and Pollux, that were born from an egg after the union of their mother, Leda, with Zeus, who is disguised as a swan. The beautiful Helen of Troy came out from the second egg. The Dioscuroi were attributed with preventative and repellent evil powers. It was believed that they brought good fortune, and for this reason they were placed here. The central panel is a composition of vintage scenes, with mainly vines laden with grapes, humans picking grapes, but also other scenes from country life, birds, animals, and a big peacock in the centre, framed by a small-winged Eros, holding the peacock's tail. Returning back and descending the bridge, we advance to the atrium, where we will see on the left four panels in a row. The first one represents the story of Pyramus and Thisbe, two young persons that lived in Babylonia and were neighbours. As the families of the two youngsters were hostile to each other, they kept the love that united them secret. One evening they had agreed to meet under a mulberry tree by a spring. Thisbe, having her face hidden under a veil, arrived there first. And while she waited, a lioness showed up with her mouth full of blood after killing an animal. Thisbe, frightened, ran to hide herself into a nearby cave. However, in her rashness, she dropped the veil she was holding. The lioness took the veil and ripped it apart with blood left on it. Pyramus, on approaching and seeing the wild animal with the blood-stained veil of his beloved, believes that Thisbe is dead, and out of despair, he thrusts a knife into his side. When Thisbe comes back and sees Pyramus dead, unable to bear the pain, she took his knife and follows her beloved to death. This myth was saved by Ovid in Metamorphoses and gave the inspiration to Shakespeare for his plays Midsummer Night's Dream and Romeo and Juliet. On this mosaic, Thisbe is standing while Pyramus is represented half reclining. In the middle is the lioness having Thisbe's veil in her mouth. The names of the two young persons are written in Greek above them. On the second panel, which is the largest of all four, we see the story of Ikarios, an Athenian gardener who offered hospitality to Dionysus when the latter was visiting Athens. In return, the god taught Ikarios how to cultivate the vine and make wine out of its fruit, introducing in this way the viniculture to mankind. He warned him, however, to be careful with his wine. Ikarios forgot the god's advice, and while he was carrying his first vintage, he gave to two shepherds he met on the way to drink wine. They got drunk, and believing that he poisoned them, they killed him. In the scene represented here, we see to the left god Dionysus with nymph Acme, crowned with vine leaves, drinking wine. In the centre, Ikarios is depicted, and behind him the ox with the cart loaded with leather flasks full of wine. To the right, the shepherds are to be seen, drunk from the wine they have consumed. The inscription above them defines them as the first wine drinkers. Such inscriptions also exist above Ikarios, god Dionysus, and Acme. The next panel depicts Neptune and Amymone. Amymone was one of the 50 daughters of King Danaos in Peloponnesus. Once all springs in Argolis dried out, and King Danaos sent his daughters to search for water. Amymone met a satyr on her way, who tried to ravish her. She was helped, however, by Neptune, god of waters. The god, charmed by her beauty, revealed to her the spring of Lerna, thus bringing an end to the drought. On the mosaic, we see Neptune, trident in hand, advancing towards Amymone. In the middle, Eros holds a rectangular parasol in one hand and a torch in the other, while the metal jug in the centre symbolises the water. The last panel illustrates the myth of Apollo and Daphne. Daphne was a nymph, daughter of the river Peneus, that had sworn eternal chastity. God Apollo, however, fell in love with her, and after failing to convince her to consent voluntarily, he chased her. Daphne, brought to despair, asked her father to help her, and her feet immediately remained rooted on the ground. Her body was transformed into a trunk, and her hair and arms turned into branches and leaves. She was thus transformed into a tree, which remained the beloved tree of God Apollo. Here we see the scene where Daphne is transformed into a tree laurel. Next to her is her father, Peneus, reclining, and to the right, Apollo, with bow in hand, watching her with amazement. At the end of the corridor, we see the mosaic with Phaedra and Hippolytos. Phaedra was the second spouse of the king of Athens, Theseus, while Hippolytos was the son born from his first spouse, Antiope. Phaedra fell in love with Hippolytos, and one day while Theseus was away, she sent her stepson a love letter in which she confessed her love. Hippolytos did not respond to her feelings, and she was frightened of the consequences of her action. When Theseus returned, she accused Hippolytos for what she had done, that is to say, for sending her a letter in which he confessed his love to her. Theseus, outraged, asked God Neptune to punish his son, and he sent a wild bull that frightened the horses of Hippolytos, throwing him on the ground and killing him. After Hippolytos' death, stricken by remorse, Phaedra killed herself. The scene we see here depicts Phaedra seated, while Hippolytos has in his hand the letter she sent him and seems embarrassed. On Phaedra's side, an Eros holds a burning torch, symbolizing the passion burning in her heart. Equally important is the fact that Eros is depicted only on her side, thus showing that feelings were not mutual. Proceeding to the left and then to the right, we will see a large room decorated with a polychrome geometric pattern. Its decoration consists of two bands forming circles between them, filled with objects and utensils of daily use, like craters, jugs, trays, and others. The intervals between them are decorated with a great variety of geometric motifs. Further to the right, we find a beautiful mosaic that represents the rape of Ganymede. The panel's field consists of a combination of octagons and meanders. It represents the moment in which Zeus, in the form of an eagle, carries away young Ganymede and lifts him to the sky. Ganymede was a shepherd from Troy, who was considered as the most beautiful of all mortals. Therefore, Zeus decided to carry him away and bring him to Olympus, where he became the cupbearer of gods. This mosaic is a copy of an older one, which was done for a different site. Thus, the mosaicist, being obliged to adapt it in the dimensions of this spot, had to trim the tips of the eagle's wings. Turning to the right, we reach the atrium area, an area which, as mentioned, was used as an internal courtyard and gave light into the house. The roof was sloping, just like today, aiming to collect rainwater through the gutters to store it in underground cisterns. Around the atrium, the floor is decorated with mosaics depicting hunting scenes. Such scenes were the most beloved subject and particularly popular in northern Egypt, from where they spread throughout the entire Roman Empire. This also explains the variety of exotic beasts illustrated here, many of which are not indigenous to Cyprus. Of particular importance is the representation of the mouflon, the largest endemic animal of Cyprus. Westwards of the atrium, we find the most plain of all mosaics of the house, which is in black and white and has a geometric pattern. The mosaics are also twice as large compared to the others. At this very spot, however, an important treasure was hidden, which was discovered during the construction works of the shed. About 2,500 Ptolemaic coins were found in an amphora, which date to the period between 204 and 88 BC. And this is the most significant treasure that was found in Cyprus. The coins were minted in Paphos. As a capital, it had its own mint. Next to the mosaic in black and white, there is a room with soil floor, and after that, a room with geometric design. Here, in four rows and four panels in each row, a different geometric pattern is represented each time. The wealth of colours and the complicated geometric patterns make these panels particularly impressive. These are rare for Eastern Mediterranean, in contradiction to areas of today's France, where they were very common. Right next to it, in a small room, there is a panel with an elaborate geometric pattern, and in the middle, a peacock. with its fully spread, rich feathers. As we have mentioned earlier on, the intense colours on mosaics, like the blue in this case, are not stones, but glass, which was probably manufactured in Paphos, as glass workshops have been discovered here. The Villa of Theseus. We come out from the house of Dionysus and advance westwards, where at a distance of about 150 metres, the ruins of a big building known as the Villa of Theseus are to be found. Its palatial character, the size and luxury that existed in this building, leads to the conclusion that it was the villa of the Roman proconsul of Cyprus. It was built at the end of the 3rd century AD and was destroyed by earthquakes in the 4th century AD. After the earthquakes, it was rebuilt and was completely destroyed and abandoned during the Arab raids in the 7th century AD. It is the largest building of all known public buildings in the entire Roman Cyprus. It measures 120 by 80 metres and consists of more than 100 rooms, which are built in the four wings around a colonnaded open courtyard. In the eastern, western and northern wing, the residential, domestic, working and communal areas are located, while the official and ritual areas lay in the southern wing. Ruins of baths have been unearthed in the southeastern part. We find in the villa different building phases that are represented through finds, architectural parts and mosaics originating from the 3rd, 4th and 5th century AD. By advancing towards the modern wooden construction and going up to the left on the elevated section, we can have a general view of the baths, which are on the southeastern corner of the building. Unlike other large baths, the bathers here did not have to follow a predetermined direction. The frigidarium, that is to say the cold room, is large and is located in the centre. It is decorated with a geometric mosaic. On the north side, there are two big basins for cold ablutions, which were lavered with marble slabs. On the south side are the heated rooms of the baths. Hot air passed from the nearby fire chambers and heated the hypocaust floors of the moderately heated room, the steam bath and the warm bath. There were also changing rooms, latrines and rooms for anointing with essential oils. All rooms were decorated with mosaic floors, murals and marble revetment on the walls. The baths remained in use for a long period of time, and during their last years of operation, they were also used by the public. We advance on the wooden corridor, where we will find to the left a big mosaic representation. The mythical scene of Theseus who kills the Minotaur is depicted on this composition. It is the most ancient mosaic of the 3rd century AD. The scene is represented in a circular space, with Theseus as the central figure, getting prepared to kill the Minotaur in the labyrinth. Behind him is the personification of labyrinth, in the form of an old man. Two feminine figures are depicted above them, Ariadne to the left, with the help of whom Theseus managed to come out from the labyrinth, and Crete to the right. The circular decoration around the composition depicts the figured representation of labyrinth. According to Greek mythology, Theseus was the son of King Aegeus and one of the heroes of Athens. Athenians had been compelled by Minos, king of Crete, to send every 7 years, as a tribute of subordination, 7 young boys and 7 young girls as prey to the Minotaur, who lived in his palace's labyrinth. Theseus decided to travel with these young people to Crete in order to kill the Minotaur and release his homeland from this painful tribute. King Aegeus, with pain in the soul, sent his son with the others, asking him to replace the black cloths of the boat with white ones upon his return, thus giving a sign that he came back alive. In Crete, Theseus managed to enter the labyrinth, to kill the Minotaur, and to come out safely, thanks to the thread given to him by Ariadne, the daughter of King Minos, who fell in love with him and decided to help him. Theseus takes Ariadne with him, and together with the other young people, they sail back to Athens, They forget, however, to change the black sails on the boat.